a thin, oily sheen across the surface. He drank quickly before it had a chance to warm up.
"Look, I'm sorry," Plum said. "I didn't mean to snap at you. God knows this isn't your fault. It's just... I'm having trouble."
She shook her head helplessly.
"I don't know what I'm doing. I haven't told my parents what happened yet. I don't know how to do it. Breakbills was a big, big deal to them. I guess they're kind of over-invested in me. I'm an only child."
"Do you want me to talk to them?"
"Hmm."
She sized him up.
"No, I don't think that's going to help."
"I'm an only child, too, though my parents were more like under-invested in me."
"Right. See, but for me, it's going to mess them up."
"But it's good that they care," Quentin said. "I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but if they really love you, they'll love you whatever happens."
"Oh, they'll love me." Plum's voice was rising again. "They'll love me, all right. They'll just spend the rest of their lives looking at me like a sick bird with a broken wing that will never get better."
She sucked fiercely at her mineral water through a straw. Then she went on.
"I don't know. Anyway, this came along, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I thought I'd take a look, and here I am, taking it. It's different, anyway. What about you?"
"Similar," Quentin said.
"I got a letter. I was going to ignore it, but then I found myself suddenly without employment. I was curious, and here we are." "Don't get me wrong," she said. "I do feel some responsibility for that."
"Forget about it."
"I just seriously forget it. I made my own choices." He said it without heat. It was the truth. "So do you think we can pull this thing off?"
"I have no idea," Quentin said. "That bird is spending a lot of money. It has to be reasonably confident."
"Or reasonably desperate."
Quentin could feel the martini doing its wintry work, frosting over his mind, silvering over his frontal lobes, preparing the ground for a proper hard freeze. He hadn't eaten dinner, and it was coming on fast. He thought he might just order another one.
"Do you miss breakbills?"
She didn't look at him. On TV, a headed ball pinged off the crossbar.
"Of course I do," he said.
"All the time. But I'm getting used to it. It's not the worst feeling in the world, and there's a lot more to life than school. I'm trying to make the most of it."
"Now you do sound like a Pollyanna."
Quentin grinned. It was pretty clear that Plum was going to get through this. She was young and unworldly, but she was also very tough and very smart. Maybe they could help each other. He caught the bartender's eye and tapped his glass. "I'll tell you what I'm wondering about," he said. "I'm wondering about how we're going to get that suitcase open, if the couple can't."
"I have a theory about that. I don't think you'll like it, though."
"Why not?"
"Because I don't like it," Plum said. "There's something about me you should probably..."
"Chachachos!"
Somebody clapped them both on the shoulder at the same time. It was Stoppard.
"What are we drinking?"
He looked happy the way only somebody who was inebriated for the first time in his life could be happy. It was incredible that they were even serving him here, considering that he was both underage and overdrunk. He frowned at them blearily.
"Wait," he said. "You two know each other or something? From before?"
"You could say that," Quentin said.
"It's not what you think," said Plum.
"Uh-huh,"
Stoppard leered knowingly. "It really isn't."
"I just ruined his life, that's all," Plum said. "And mine. And I think maybe I'll have that drink now, after all."
Chapter 7
You could say it all started out as an innocent prank, but that wouldn't strictly be true. Even Plum had to admit it wasn't all that innocent. And maybe, deep down, that was why she did it. Plum was president of the league, unelected but undisputed,
and also its founder. In enlisting the others, she had presented the League as a glorious old Brakebills tradition, which it actually wasn't, though since Brakebills had been around for something like 400 years, it seemed very likely to Plum that there must have been another League at some point in the past, or at any rate something along the same general lines. You couldn't rule out the possibility, though in actual fact she got the idea from a P.G. Woodhouse story. The thing was this. Wharton was behaving badly, and in the judgment of the League he would have to be pranked for it. Then maybe he would cut it out or behave a little less badly, or at least the League would have the satisfaction of having caused Wharton to suffer for his crimes. You couldn't call it innocent, but you had to admit it was pretty understandable. And anyway, was there even any such thing as an innocent prank? Plum loved Brakebills. It was November of her senior year, and she still wasn't sick of it, not a bit. She loved its many and varied and intricate traditions and rituals and mythologies with an unironic and boosterish love that she refused to be embarrassed about. If anything, she thought there should be more of them, which was one reason she started the League. They met after hours in a funny little trapezoidal study off the West Tower that, as far as Plum could tell, had fallen off the faculty's magical security grid, so it was safe to break curfew there. She lay full length on her back on the floor, which was the position from which she usually conducted League business. The rest of the girls were scattered around the room on couches and chairs, limp and spent, like confetti from a successful but exhausting party that everybody was kind of relieved was now all but over. Plum made the room go silent. It was a little spell that ate sound in about a 10-yard radius. When Plum did a magic trick, everybody noticed. "Let's put it to a vote," she said gravely. "All those in favor of pranking Wharton, say aye." The ayes came back in a range of tones, righteous zeal, ironic detachment, sleepy acquiescence. From Plum's vantage point on the floor, with her eyes closed, her long brown hair splayed out in a fan on the carpet, which had once been soft and woolly but which had been trodden down into a shiny, hard-packed gray, it sounded more or less unanimous. She dispensed with a show of nays. They were doing this. Wharton's crime was not a matter of life and death, but a stop would be put to it. This the League swore. Darcy, sitting slumped down on the couch, studied her reflection in a long mirror with a scarred gilt frame. She had a big, poofy 1970s afro. It even had an afro pick sticking out of it. She toyed with her image in the mirror. With both of her long, elegant, brown hands, she worked a spell that stretched it and then squished it, stretched, then squished, stretch, squish. Her head blew up to the size of a beach ball. It stretched out like a sausage balloon. The technicalities were beyond Plum, but then mirror magic was Darcy's discipline. It was a bit show-offy of her, but it's not like Darcy had a lot of opportunities to use it. The facts of the Wharton case were as follows. At Brakebills, most serving duties at dinner were carried out by first years, who then ate separately afterward. But by tradition, one favored fourth year was chosen every year to serve as wine steward, in charge of pairings and pourings and whatnot, and trusted with the key to the wine closet. Wharton had had this honor bestowed upon him, and not for no reason. He did know a lot about wine. Or at any rate, he could remember the names of a whole lot of different regions and appellations and whatever else. But in the judgment of the League, Wharton had sinned against the honor of his office, sinned most grievously by systematically short-pouring the wine, especially for the fifth years, the Finns in Brakebill's parlance, who were allowed 2 glasses each with dinner. Seriously, these were like 2/3 pours. Everybody agreed. Plum wasn't much of a drinker personally, but the League took any threat to its wine supply seriously. For such a crime, there could be no forgiveness. "What do you suppose he does with it all?" Emma said. "Does with what?" "All that extra wine. He must be skimming it off. I bet he ends up with an extra bottle every night off the books. There were 8 girls in the league, of whom 6 were present. Emma was the only second year.
I don't know, Plum said. I guess he drinks it.
He couldn't get through a bottle a night, Darcy said.
He and his boyfriend, then. What's his name? It's Greek.
Epifanio, Darcy and Chelsea said it together. Chelsea lay on the couch at the opposite end from Darcy, knees drawn up, lazily trying to mess up Darcy's mirror tricks. It was always easier to screw up somebody else's spell than it was to cast one yourself. That was one of the many small unfairnesses of magic. Darcy frowned and concentrated harder, pushing back. The interference caused an audible buzz, and under the stress, Darcy's reflection twisted and spiraled in on itself.
Stop, she said. You're going to break it.
He's probably got some permanent spell running that eats it up, Emma said. Has to feed it wine once a day, like a virility thing.
Wait, Plum said. You're suggesting that Wharton has a wine-powered spell going 24/7 on his penis?
Well, Emma flushed mauve. She'd overstepped herself in the presence of her elders and betters.
You know, he's so buff.
While everybody else was distracted by the question of Wharton's virility, Chelsea caused Darcy's reflection to collapse in on itself creepily, like it had gotten sucked into a black hole, and then to vanish altogether. In the mirror it looked like she wasn't even there, except that the couch cushion was slightly depressed.
Ha! Chelsea said.
Buff does not mean virile. That was Lucy, a pale and intensely philosophical Finn. Her tone betrayed a touch of what might have been the bitterness of personal experience. Anyway, I bet he gives it to the ghost.
There is no ghost, Darcy said.
Somebody was always saying that Brakebills had a ghost. It was a thing this year. There was practically a cult around it. Emma claimed to have seen it once, watching her through a window. Wharton said he had, too. Plum secretly wanted a ghost sighting of her own, but you could never find it when you were looking for it. She wasn't completely convinced it existed. It was like saying there used to be a league. No one could prove it either way.
Come to that, Chelsea said. What does virile mean?
Means he's got spunk in his junk, Darcy said.
Girls, please, Plum said. Neither Wharton's spunk nor his junk is germane here. The question is what to do about the missing wine. Who's got a plan?
You've got a plan, Darcy and Chelsea said at the same time again.
The two of them were like stage twins. It was true. Plum always had a plan. Her brain just seemed to secrete them naturally, leaving her no choice but to share them with the world around her. She had a bit of a manic streak. Plum's plan was to take advantage of what she perceived to be Wharton's Achilles heel, which was his pencils. He didn't use the school-issued ones, which, as far as Plum was concerned, were entirely functional and sufficient under the day. Deep Brakebills blue in color, with Brakebills in gold letters down the side. But Wharton didn't like them. He said they were too fat. He didn't like their hand feel. The lead was mushy. He brought his own from home instead, very expensive ones. In truth, Wharton's personal pencils were remarkable, olive green and made from some hard, oily, aromatic wood that released a waxy aroma reminiscent of distant, exotic rainforest trees. The erasers were bound in rings of a dull gray brushed steel that looked too industrial and high carbon for the task of merely containing the erasers, which were, instead of the usual fleshy pink, a light-devouring black. He kept them in a flat silver case like a cigarette case, which also contained, in its own crushed velvet nest, a little knife that he used to keep them sharpened to wicked points. Plus he must have been into debate or academic decathlon or something in some earlier stage of his life, because he was always doing these pencil tricks with them, of the kind generally used to intimidate rival mathletes. He did them constantly, unconsciously, and apparently involuntarily. It was annoying. Plum's plan was for the League to steal the pencils and hold them for ransom, the ransom being an explanation of what the hell Wharton did with all that wine, along with a pledge to stop doing same. By 11:30 that night, the League was yawning, and Darcy and Chelsea had restored Darcy's reflection and then begun wrangling with it all over again, but the groundwork had been laid. The plan had been fully explained, fleshed out, approved, improved, and then made needlessly complex. Cruel, curly little barbs had been added to it, and all roles had been assigned. It was rough justice, but someone had to enforce order at Breakbills, and if the faculty didn't, then the League's many hands were forced. The administration might turn a blind eye if it chose, but the League's many eyes were sharp and unblinking. Darcy's image shivered and blurred, trapped between spell and counterspell like a teacup in a vice.
"Stop it,"
Darcy said, really annoyed now.
"I told you."
She had told her, and now it did. The mirror broke with a loud, sharp tick, like one forward increment of a clock's works. A shatter-white star appeared in the lower right-hand corner of the glass, surrounded by concentric rings and spreading fracture tendrils. For some reason it made Plum uncomfortable. For a moment she felt like the little room was a bathysphere that had reached crush depth. The windows were cracking, and the cold, heavy, mindless ocean was about to come pouring in.
"Oh, shit," Chelsea said. Her hands flew to her mouth. "I hope that wasn't, like, super expensive."
Plum got up at 8 the next morning, late by her standards, but instead of rejuvenating her brain, the extra sleep had just made it all muzzy. It had smeared all those clear thoughts she was supposed to be having all over the inside of her skull. Her depressive tendency, the flip side of her manic streak, was stirring. Why were they even doing this, it wanted to know. What a waste of time, of effort, of pencils. Plum needed to get moving, but she was having trouble attaching meanings to things. The meanings kept peeling off like old stickers. As a Finn who'd finished her required coursework, Plum was taking all seminars that semester, and her first class was a colloquium on period magic, 15th century continental to be specific. Lots of elemental stuff and weird divination techniques and Johannes Hartlieb. Holly, a fellow leaguer, moon-faced and pretty, except for one ear, which was covered in a port wine birthmark, sat opposite her across the table, and such was Plum's smeary state that Holly had to touch her sharp little nose meaningfully twice before Plum remembered that that was the signal that stages 1 and 2 of the plan had been completed successfully. Stage 1. Crude but effective. A few hours earlier, Chelsea's boyfriend would have smuggled her into the boys' tower under pretense of a pre-dawn sex date. Nature having taken its course, Chelsea would have gone to Wharton's door, pressed her back against it, touched her fingers to her temples in a gesture so habitual that she no longer knew she did it, rolled her eyes back into her head, and entered his room in a wispy, silvery, astral state. Chelsea did it all the time. Astral projection was her discipline. But it was still one of the most flat-out beautiful pieces of magic Plum had ever seen. Chelsea tossed his room for the pencil case, found it, and grasped it with both of her barely substantial hands. She couldn't get the pencil case out of the room that way, but she didn't have to. All she had to do was lift it up to where it could be seen in the window. Wharton himself might or might not have been watching this, depending on whether or not he was asleep, but it mattered not. Let him see. Because once Chelsea got the case over by the window, Ernest Lucy had line of sight to it from a window in an empty lecture hall in the wing opposite Wharton's room, which meant she could teleport the pencil case in that direction, from inside Wharton's room to midair, outside it. 3 feet was about as far as she could jump it, but that was plenty. Thank God for people with actual useful disciplines. The pencil case would then fall 40 feet to where Emma waited shivering in the bushes in the cold November pre-dawn to catch it in a blanket. No magic required. Effective? Undeniably. Needlessly complex? Perhaps. But needless complexity was the League's signature. That was how the League rolled. Then it was on to stage two. Breakfast of Champions. Wharton would descend late, having spent the morning frantically searching his room. Through a fog of anxiety, he would barely notice that his morning oatmeal had been plunked down in front of him not by some anonymous first year, but by the purple-eared Holly, in guise of same. The first mouthful would not sit right with him. He would stop and examine his morning oatmeal more closely. It would be garnished, not with the usual generous pinches of brown sugar, but with a light dusting of aromatic olive-green pencil shavings. Compliments of the League. As the day wore on, Plum got into the spirit of the prank. She'd known she would. It was mostly just her mornings that were bad. It took a lot of energy to keep being Plum. Some days she just needed a few hours to get up to speed. Her schedule ground forward. Accelerated advanced kinetics, quantum grammary, joined hands tandem magics, manipulation of ligneous plants. Plum's course load would have been daunting for a doctoral candidate, possibly several doctoral candidates, but Plum had arrived at Breakbills with a head full of more magical theory and practice than most people left with. She wasn't one of these standing starters, the cold openers who reeled through their first year with aching hands and eyes full of stars. Plum was clever, and Plum had come to Breakbills prepared. As the only accredited college for magic on the North American continent, Breakbills had a very large applicant pool to draw from, and it drank that pool dry. Technically, nobody really applied there. Dean Fogg simply skimmed the cream of high school seniors off the top. The cream of the cream, the outliers, the extreme cases of precocious genius and obsessive motivation, the statistical freaks who had the brains and the high pain tolerance that the study of magic required. Fogg took them aside and made them an offer they couldn't refuse, or at any rate, if they could refuse it, they wouldn't remember it. Privately, Plum thought they could put a tiny bit more emphasis in the selection process on emotional intelligence, along with the other kind. The Breakbills student body was a bit of a psychological menagerie. Carrying that much onboard cognitive processing power had a way of distorting your personality, and to actually want to work that hard, you had to be at least a little bit screwed up. Plum's discipline was camouflage magic, the magic of concealment, and she was considered an illusionist, which she was perfectly happy about. Being an illusionist at Breakbills was, if Plum said it herself, a pretty sweet deal. You got to hang out in a tiny, invisible folly castle on the edge of the forest that was quite difficult to find unless you had an illusionist-type discipline. The castle was delicate and gossamer and very Neuschwanstein, which was a nice way of saying, though Plum didn't say it, kind of Disney. To get up in one of the towers, you climbed a ladder inside it, like you were negotiating a Jeffrey's tube, and there was just enough room for a little chair and a desk inside the round room at the top. She didn't like to be partisan about it, but it was way better than that pokey cottage the physical kids got stuck with. When they had parties, the whole place could be made to twinkle and float up into the air a little ways, like a fairy castle, connected to the ground by only a rickety, railingless staircase, which people were always falling off of drunk onto the soft grass below. It reminded her of the floating castle at the end of the Phantom Toll Booth. Hell yes, it was Disney. Disney FTW. Once in a while, people would ask Plum what the hell kind of an adolescent she'd had that she arrived at Breakbills so cocked, locked, and ready to rock. She told them the truth, which was that she'd grown up on an island near Seattle in comfortable surroundings, the daughter of a mixed marriage, one magician, one non. She was an only child, and they'd had high standards for Plum, Daddy especially. He was the magician of the couple. As the one basket they'd managed to weave, she had to hold all their eggs, so they'd homeschooled her, and once her talent for magic revealed itself, they'd made damn sure she made good on it. Daddy sat with her and made her practice her languages and her exercises, and she'd made very good indeed. True, she'd never been to prom or played a competitive sport that you couldn't play sitting down and in complete silence, but you don't make a magic omelet without breaking some magic eggs. That was the truth. And if she liked and trusted the person who asked, she would add that, yes, it was kind of a lot to deal with. Her outward affect was bright and capable, and that was no illusion. But equally real was the yawning pit of exhaustion inside her. She just felt so tired sometimes. And because of everything her family asked of her, she was ashamed of being tired. She could not, would not, let the pit swallow her up as much as she sometimes wanted it to. She could have gone on to say even more, which was that magic ran in her family, sort of, that it was something of a tradition, but she never did. People tended to be a bit funny about it, and actually Plum felt a bit funny about it, too, so she kept it to herself. It wasn't hard, because she'd lived most of her life in America and had not even a trace of an English accent, and it was on her mother's side, so Chatwin wasn't even her last name. It was her mother's name, though. She was the daughter of Rupert Chatwin's only son, and that made Plum, as far as she knew, the last living direct descendant of the famous Chatwins of the Fillory books. No one else in that generation had managed to reproduce, so she was the heir to whatever Chatwins were heir to, though, as she was not slow to point out, she wasn't a Chatwin at all, but a Purchase, Plum Polson Purchase. Chatwin wasn't even her middle name. And as a matter of fact, there had been a sum of money, royalties that Plover had graciously set aside for the children who'd made his fortune. His second fortune. He'd been rich already when he started writing about Fillory. Rupert had used his share to buy a big house in the countryside outside Penzance, which he barely ever left until the army called him up to die in World War II. Plum had seen pictures of it, one of those houses that always gets referred to as a pile, a big Georgian pile. It had a name, but she'd forgotten it. Her mother had grown up there, but she didn't talk much about her childhood. A drafty, echoing place was how she described it. Not a place to be a kid in. The floor was littered with falls of plaster from the crumbling moldings, and Plum's mother spent winter afternoons huddled up on the stairs by a huge heating duct, big enough for her to have crawled into if the entrance hadn't been covered by a knotted, wrought-iron grate and letting the lukewarm air wash weakly over her. When she grew up, Plum's mother left her heritage behind. Her Chatwin ancestors struck her as dangerously melancholy and fanciful, and she sold the house and its contents and moved to America to become a publicist for Microsoft. She met Plum's dad at a charity ball, and it wasn't till they were well into their courtship that he revealed to her what he really did in all his spare time. Once Mom got over the shock of a lifetime, they went ahead and got married anyway, and had Plum, and they were a happy, magical, nuclear family. You couldn't talk about the Fillory stuff at Breakbills. Everybody loved Fillory. It was their most precious childhood fantasy. They used to run around their backyards or basement rec rooms, or whatever they ran around in, pretending they were Martin Chatwin, boy hero of a magical world of green fields and talking animals, where they would attain total and complete self-actualization. And Plum got that, totally and completely. It was their fantasy, and it was perfect and innocent and true, at least in the way that such things were true. She would never try to take that away from them. And literally everybody at Breakbills grew up on Fillory. The place was one big 5-year Fillory convention. But Plum, through whose very veins the mighty blood of the Chatwins flowed, did not grow up on Fillory. They didn't even have the books. Plum had only read the first one, The World in the Walls, and that was on the sly, in snatches, at the public library. Plum's parents didn't smoke, didn't drink, and they didn't read Christopher Plover. Plum didn't mind. Once you found out that magic was real, fictional wonderlands were pretty small change by comparison. So she quietly opted out of a public life as the last scion of the Chatwin line. She could do without the fuss, being the living incarnation of the most innocent, ardent childhood fantasies of pretty much everybody you met was not actually a gift from the gods. But there was more to it than that. There always had been. Underneath her mother's scorn and indifference, there was something else, and Plum wasn't completely sure, but she thought it might be fear. Fillory had made the Chatwin family famous, but most people didn't know, or they knew but chose not to think about it, that it had ruined them, too. Martin, Plum's great-uncle, High King and hero of the Fillory books, had disappeared when he was 13. He was never found. Jane, the youngest, the Moppet, vanished when she was the same age. The others survived, more or less, but no one came out of it unscathed. Helen changed her name and ended her life as an evangelical Christian in Texas. Fiona Chatwin got along by never once mentioning Fillory as an adult. When pressed on the subject, she exhibited faint surprise and claimed she'd never heard of it. As for Rupert, Plum's great-grandfather, he was, by all accounts, a wreck of a man who spent his adult life in neurotic seclusion until Field Marshal Erwin Rommel came along to put him out of his misery. Something had happened to that family. There was a curse on them, and its name was Fillory. Plum's mom talked about Fillory like it was almost real. Maybe it was the books, maybe it was Plover, maybe it was the parents or the war or fate, but when Fillory and Earth touched, the collision was pure damage, and the Chatwins were the point of contact. They were right there at ground zero, and they were blown to vapor like the human shadows at Hiroshima. Plum was pretty sure that none of them had attained total or even partial self-actualization. Plum's mother wanted no part of that, and a good thing, too, as far as Plum was concerned, because deep down she felt the fear, too. When Plum discovered magic, it was the most magnificent kind of surprise, the kind that never got less surprising. The world was even more interesting than she thought it was. But it also made her uneasy. Because just speaking logically here, if magic was real, then could you still be absolutely 100% positive that Fillory wasn't? And if Fillory was real, which it almost certainly wasn't, then whatever it was that had torn through an entire generation of her family like a lion through a flock of loitering gazelle was real too, and it might still be out there. Plum dug into magic with both hands, but always at the back of her mind was the thought that she might go too far, dig too deep, and dig up something that she would wish had stayed buried. She especially thought about that when those depressive anhedonic chemicals were singing in her bloodstream, because then she kind of wanted to dig it up. She wanted to look it in the face. She could hear Fillory calling to her, or if not Fillory, then something, somewhere beautiful and distant and siren-like, where she had never been, but that was also somehow home. And she knew what side of the family her depressive streak came from. That was her Chatwin inheritance, right there. So she kept her Chatwinity to herself. She didn't want people pushing at it, picking at it, lest its ragged, unstable edges start to unravel. Sometimes Plum wondered if there was a way to use her discipline to hide not just things, but words, facts, names, feelings, hide them so well that even she couldn't find them. What she wanted was to hide herself from herself. But she couldn't. That was stupid. You were who you were. You lived your life. You didn't brood. Ruminative thinking, that's what her shrink had called it. You got on with things. You founded the League. You pranked the hell out of Wharton. Plum wound up having a pretty good day. At any rate, it was a lot better than Wharton's. In first period, he found more pencil shavings on the seat of his chair. Walking to lunch, he found his pockets stuffed full of jet-black pencil eraser rubbings. It was like a horror movie. His precious pencils were being tortured to death, minute by minute, in an undisclosed location, and he was powerless to save them. He would rue his short poring ways, so he would. Passing Wharton by chance in a courtyard, Plum let her eyes slide past his with a slow smile she felt only a little bit bad about. Was it her imagination, or did he look just the slightest bit haunted? Maybe Breakbills did have a ghost after all. Maybe it was Plum. Finally, and this was Plum's touch, and she privately thought it was the deftest one, in his fourth period class, a practicum on diagramming magical energies, Wharton found that the Breakbills pencil he was using, on top of its bad hand feel and whatever else, wouldn't draw what he wanted it to. Whatever spell he tried to diagram, whatever points and rays and vectors he tried to sketch, they inevitably formed a series of letters. The letters spelled out, "Compliments of the League." Chapter 8 Dinners at Breakbills had a nice formal pomp about them. When one was cornered by sad, nostalgic Breakbills graduates who had peaked in college and were back reliving their glory days, sooner or later they always got around to reminiscing about evenings in the old dining hall. It was long and narrow and shadowy and paneled in dark wood and lined with murky oil paintings of past deans in various states of period dress. Light came from hideous, lopsided silver candelabras placed along the table every 10 feet, and the candle flames were always flaring up or snuffing out or changing color under the influence of some stray spell or other. Everybody wore identical Breakbills uniforms. Students' names were inscribed on the table at their assigned places, which changed nightly according to, apparently, the whims of the table. That night, Plum ate her first course as usual, two rather uninspired crab cakes, skipping the wine, as she usually did, then excused herself to go to the ladies. As Plum passed behind her, Darcy discreetly held out the silver pencil case behind her back, and Plum pocketed it. She wasn't going to the ladies, of course. Well, she was, but only because she had to. She wouldn't be going back after. Plum walked briskly through the empty house to the senior common room, which the faculty rarely bothered to lock, so confident were they that no student would dare to cross its threshold unchaperoned. But Plum dared. The senior common room was a cavernous, silent, L-shaped chamber, lined with bookcases and littered with shiny red leather couches and chairs. It was empty, or almost. The only person there was Professor Coldwater, and she wasn't worried about him. She figured he might be there. Most of the faculty were at dinner, but according to the roster, it was his turn to eat late, with the first years. He was an odd one, Professor Coldwater. Young for a professor. Kept to himself. You rarely saw him outside the classroom. He was new, and opinion about him was divided as to whether he was a genius or a bit insane, or both. He had a cult following among the students. His lectures were peppered with exotic magics and bravura demonstrations, or so the legends went. Plum had never seen one. She was way past minor mendings. The other professors didn't seem that wild about him. He was constantly getting handed the crap jobs that nobody else wanted, like eating with the first years. He didn't seem to mind, or maybe he just didn't notice. She got the impression he had something else going on, something that was part of a larger frame of reference than the changeless yet ephemeral world of Breakbills. He was always hurrying in and out of the library with thick books under his arms, mumbling to himself like he was doing math problems in his head. That was one of the reasons she wasn't too worried about his catching her in the senior common room. Even if he did notice her, he probably wouldn't care enough to write her up. More likely, he would just kick her out. Either way, totally worth it. Right now, Professor Coldwater was at the far end of the room with his back to her. He was tall and skinny and stood bolt upright with his weird white hair, a wine glass forgotten in his hand, staring into the fire. Plum breathed a silent prayer to whatever saint it was who watched over absent-minded professors and made sure their minds stayed absent. She cut swiftly through the right angle of the L into its shorter arm where he couldn't see her. Because it was time for the grand reveal. Toward the end of dinner, when Horton was ready to bring out the dessert wines, he would retreat to the wine closet, which wasn't so much a closet as a room the size of a studio apartment. To his shock, he would find Plum already in possession of same, having entered it on the sly through a secret back passage from the senior common room. Fait accompli. Then she would present the League's demands, and he would capitulate to every single one of them. It was the chanciest bit of the plan, because the existence of this secret back passage was a matter of speculation. But whatever, if it didn't work, she'd find some normal, less dramatic way to corner him. She looked quickly over her shoulder, Coldwater still out of view and or otherwise engaged. Then knelt by the wainscoting. She took a deep breath. Third panel from the left. The one on the end was half a panel, not sure whether she should count it or not. Well, she tried both ways. She traced a word in Old English with her finger, spelling it out in a runic alphabet, the Elder Futhark, and meanwhile clearing her mind of everything but the taste of a really oaky Chardonnay paired with a hot buttered toast point. Lemon squeezy. She felt the locking spell release even before it happened. The panel swung outward on a set of previously invisible hinges. Annoyingly, though, the passage had been sealed. 10 feet in, it ended in a brick wall, and the bricks had been bricked in such a way as to form a design that Plum recognized as an absolutely brutal, hardening charm. Just a charm, yes, but a massively powerful one. Not undergraduate stuff. Some professor had bothered to put this here, and they'd spent some time on it, too. Plum pursed her lips and snorted out through her nose. Crouching down, she stepped into the passage and pulled the little door shut behind her. She snapped on a simple light spell, a friendly, glowy will-o'-the-wisp. Then she stared at the brick wall for 5 minutes in the dimness of the little passageway, lost to the world in an analytical trance. In her mind, the pattern in the bricks floated free and hung before her all on its own, pure and abstract and shining. Mentally, she entered the pattern, inhabited it, pushed at it from the inside with cognitive fingers, feeling for any sloppy joins or subtle imbalances. There must be something. Come on, Plum. It's easier to break magic than to make it. You know this. Whoever drew this seal was smart, but was she smarter than Plum? There was something odd about the angles. The essence of a glyph like this wasn't the angles, it was the underlying topology. You could deform it a good deal and not lose the power as long as its essential geometric properties remained intact. The angles of the joins were, up to a point, arbitrary. But the funny thing about the angles of these joins was that they were funny. They were sharper than they needed to be. They were non-arbitrary. There was a pattern to them, a pattern within the pattern. 17 degrees, 3 degrees. 17 and 3. 2 of them here, 2 of them there. The only angles that appeared twice. When she saw it, she snorted again. It was a code. A moronically simple alphabetical code. 17 and 3. Q and C. Quentin
cold water. It was a signature of sorts, a watermark, a cold water mark. Professor Coldwater had set this seal, and when she saw that, she saw it all. He'd wanted a weak spot, a back door in case he needed to undo it later. His vanity signature was the flaw in the pattern. She extracted the little knife from Wharton's pencil case and worked it into the crumbly mortar around one particular brick. She ran it all the way around the edge. Then she knocked on the brick with her knuckles. Shave and a haircut. Free and loose, it pushed out cleanly. Clunk. Deprived of that one brick, and hence the integrity of its pattern, the rest of the wall gave up the ghost and fell apart. Why would he have sealed it up? And why him in particular? Everybody knew Coldwater was a wine lush. She could always ask him. He was standing about 20 yards away. Or she could get on with what she was here for. It was chilly in the passageway, much chillier than in the cozy senior common room. The walls were unfinished boards over very old stone. Dead reckoning, it was about 100 yards from the senior common room to the back of the wine closet, but she'd only gone half that distance before she came to a door, fortunately unlocked and unsealed. More passage, then another door, like she was going through a series of airlocks. Weird. You could never tell what you were going to find in this place, even after living here for 4.5 years. The fifth door opened onto open air. That was very odd. It was a pretty little square courtyard that she'd never seen before, maybe 20 yards on a side, mostly grass, with one tree, a pear tree, espaliered against a high stone wall. She'd always found espaliers a little creepy. It was like somebody had crucified the poor thing. Also, she was almost positive that there shouldn't have been a moon tonight. "Nutso," Plum said quietly. She frowned at it. The moon looked back at her blankly, pretending not to care. She hurried across the courtyard to the next door. It opened directly onto one of the upper floors of the library. That definitely wasn't right. She was traversing some magically non-contiguous spaces here. The Brakebills library was arranged around the interior walls of a tower that narrowed toward the top, and this must have been one of the teensy-tiny uppermost floors which Plum had only ever glimpsed from far below, and which, to be honest, she'd always assumed were just there for show. She never thought there were any actual books up there. In fact, now she realized that these upper floors must be built to false perspective, to make the tower look taller than it was, because it was very tiny indeed, barely a balcony, like one of those tiny houses that mad kings built for their royal dwarfs. She had to navigate it on her hands and knees. She felt like Alice in Wonderland, grown too big. The books looked real enough, though, their brown leather spines flaking like pastry, with letters stamped on them in gold. Some interminable many-volume reference work about ghosts. The other weird thing was that they weren't quite inanimate. They poked themselves out at her from the shelves, butted her as she crawled past, as if they were inviting her to open them and read, or daring her to, or begging her. A couple of them actually jabbed her in the ribs pretty hard. They must not get a lot of visitors, she thought. Probably this is like when you visit the puppies at the shelter and they all jump up and want to be petted. No, thank you. If she wished to consult them, she would be in touch via the usual channels. It was a relief to crawl through the miniature door at the far end of the balcony. It was practically a cat door, and back into a normal corridor. This was taking longer than she thought. But it wasn't too late. The main course would be half over, but there was still dessert, and she thought there was cheese tonight, too. She could still make it if she hurried. This corridor was tight, almost a crawl space. In fact, it was one. As near as she could tell, she was inside one of the walls of Brakebills. On the other side was the dining hall,
She could hear the warm hum of talk and the clank of heavy silverware, and she could look out through a couple of the paintings. There were peepholes in the eyes, like in old movies about haunted houses. In fact, they were just serving the main, a nice rare lamb spiked with spears of rosemary, and the sight of it made her hungry. She felt like she was a million miles away from everyone and everything she knew. She was a ghost herself, the skeleton at the feast, the world in the walls. She already felt nostalgic, like one of those teary alums, for back when she was sitting at the table with her bland crab cakes half an hour ago, back when she knew exactly where she was. And there was Wharton, showily pouring his mingy glasses of red, totally unrepentant. The sight emboldened her. That was why she was here. She was going to get through this, for the League. Though, God, how long was it going to take? The next door opened out onto the roof. The night air was bone cold. She hadn't been up here since the time Professor Sunderland had turned them into geese, and they'd flown down to Antarctica to study at Breakbill's South. It was lonely and quiet after the dining hall. She was very high up, higher than the leafless tops of all but the tallest trees. The roof was so sharply raked she had to crawl again, and the shingles were gritty under her palms. She could see the Hudson River off in the distance, a long, sinuous, leaden squiggle. She shivered just looking at it. And for the record, no moon. It was gone, back to its proper place. Which way? She was losing the thread. After a long, cold think, resulting in no definitive conclusions, Plum just jimmied the lock on the nearest dormer window and let herself in. She was in a student's room. Actually, if she had to, she'd guess it was Wharton's room, though she'd never seen it. "OMG," she said out loud. The irony. What were the odds? These spaces were beyond non-contiguous. Somebody at Breakbill's, possibly Breakbill's itself, was fucking with her. The room was messy as hell, which was somehow endearing since she thought of Wharton as a control freak. And it had a nice smell. She half suspected she had stumbled into a magical duel with Wharton himself, except no way could he pull off something like this. Maybe he had help. Maybe he was part of a shadowy anti-league, committed to frustrating the goals of the League. That would actually be kind of cool. This would have been a reasonable moment to bail, exit the vehicle, and slink back to the dining hall. But no, that would mean giving up, going back. And that wasn't Plum. She went forward, always forward, never look back. Eye of the tiger. She had a job to do, a mission for the League, of which she was the goddamn chief executive officer. So she wasn't going to fight against the dream logic. She was going to steer into the skid and see where it took her. Onward and downward. To leave by the front door, she knew instinctively, would have been to break the dream spell. So instead she opened Wharton's closet door, somehow confident that, yes, look, there was a small door at the back of it. Turning to take a final look around, she couldn't help but notice, by the by, on his desk, a fresh box of those pencils. He'd already got replacements. Why exactly had they thought those were the only ones? He probably had truckloads of them. She opened the door in the closet and stooped through. From here on out, her travels ran entirely on dream rails. The door took her into another courtyard, but now it was daytime. The spaces were losing temporal, contiguousness, contiguity, as well as the spatial kind. In fact, it was earlier today because there she was, Plum herself, crossing the lightly frosted grass and passing Wharton, and there was the eye sliding. It was a strange sight. But Plum's tolerance for strange had been on the rise, low this past half hour. She watched herself leave the courtyard. She wondered whether, if she shouted and waved her arms, she would hear herself and turn around, and the timeline would be permanently busted and altered, or if this was more of a two-way mirror deal. Maybe she could tip herself off, have the shrimp Fra Diavolo instead of the crab cakes. She frowned. The causality of it was tangled. Though this much at least was clear, those boots had had a good run, but it was time for them to go. On the upside, if that's what her ass looked like from behind, well, not bad. She would take it. The next door was even more temporally non-contiguous, because it put her in a different break bills entirely, though at first the difference was hard to put your finger on. It was a smaller and darker and somehow denser break bills. The ceilings were lower, the corridors were narrower, and the air smelled like wood smoke. The light was fire and candlelight. She passed an open doorway and saw a group of girls huddled together on a huge four-poster bed. They wore white nightgowns and had long, straight hair and bad teeth. Plum understood what she was seeing. This was breakbills of long ago, revolutionary-era breakbills, the ghost of breakbills past. The girls looked up only briefly, incuriously, as she passed, then went back to talking. No question what they were up to. "Another league," Plum said to herself. "I knew there must have been one." She was still savoring the satisfaction of it when she opened the next door into a room she didn't recognize at all. Until she did. She tried to back out, but the door had locked behind her. It wasn't even a room at all, but a rough, round, rock-walled cave where a group of strangers were playing out the bloody last act of some Byzantine Renaissance tragedy. Two boys were on the ground, face down, shivering as their precious blood turned the sand around them to dark muck. "Oh, fuck," Plum whispered. "Fuck, fuck, 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 fuck." She plastered herself back against the wall. She had never seen real wounds before. Five more girls and boys were standing around in various states of shock and distress and anger. One girl had a gun. The others were focusing all their magical strength on a man in a gray suit. Crazy, harsh, enchanted energies streamed out of them and crackled through the air and assaulted the man with hardly any effect other than to flap his lapels. He looked vaguely familiar, and there was something wrong with his hands. In the corner, in a heap, lay a huge, woolly carcass with one thick, curling, knobby horn visible. Oh, God! The scene was starting to clarify itself to her, to take on a horrible meaning even over and above the obvious. That ram had to be Ember, one of the twin gods of Fillory, and the man in the suit. She did recognize him. She didn't, but she did. His round, pasty face had the unmistakable stamp of a Chatwin. This was some ancestor of hers, and she was in Fillory, and it was all real, all of it. But it wasn't Fillory, not like in the books. It was a sick nightmare Fillory. The room flashed and flared with dangerous light. Rocks rained down on the man in the suit. The air smelled like cordite. She couldn't be here. She was going to go insane. Whatever it was that had chewed up her ancestors and spit them out had found her. It was here in this room with her. It was the room. "No," she breathed. "Oh, God, no! God, no!" She tried the door again, just because it had to open. It had to. She couldn't be here. And now it did. It had mercy on her, effortlessly, no resistance. It even opened out, where before it had opened in. She half ran, half fell through it, and slammed it behind her, and everything was quiet again. She was in a silent room, a safe room, the familiar homely little trapezoidal lounge where the League held its meetings. Oh, God! Oh, thank God! It was over. She was breathing hard, and she sobbed once, a dry sob. It wasn't real. It wasn't real. None of it. Or it was real, but it was over. She almost laughed. She didn't care either way as long as she was safe now. Maybe she'd fallen asleep here after the meeting last night and it was all a dream. Whatever, this whole fucked-up magical mystery tour...